Lou Anne White, and I am from Tulane University School of Public Health. But I have to say that my other hat is I spend quite a bit of time with the Louisiana Department of Health. So I'm an example of that intersection between the academic side and the public health practice side. I've served as a toxicologist there in Louisiana for the Department of Health for over 25 years before I had this color hair. My mandatory slide that says I have no financial relationships with anybody, except maybe Tulane, because I hope they keep paying me. My role in this was from the very beginning. The Louisiana Health Department was involved from the very start, but in following up on what Dr. Williams says, public health doesn't have a role or a seat at the table in the national contingency plan. So we have to depend upon our friends in the Department of Environmental Quality or the engineers and emergency response people to get things secondhand. And I will more than second his observation and his lessons learned that's one policy thing that needs to change. When everybody else goes home, public health is sitting there. And so if we're not there at the table, we can't respond immediately very well, and then we can't do all this follow-up that people are expecting us. So our role there, we saw, was how do we protect public health during this spill? It started off as it was just a small event. People thought that it was just a collapse and a burning and a blowout of an oil rig, but then 2 days later, the burning, it fell below the sea and the oil began spurting. Our first reports was that, oh, it's okay, there's no oil leaking. And then, well, there's a little bit of oil. And then, well, maybe there's a little bit more. And then finally, gosh, there's a lot of oil coming out of that well. And so we were gearing up as this went along. One of the things that helped us in Louisiana, as did many the other states, were that we did have an underlying infrastructure that we could draw upon. In Louisiana, we feel like we're the land of disasters. We had Katrina, we were all geared up. Since then, we had the formaldehyde and FEMA trailers, the Chinese drywall, and now this. So we've never down-ramped since Katrina. So one more disaster coming our way, we were ready to go. And particularly in the environmental health section where I work, we've been getting data, analyzing it, so we were well primed to say the type of data we needed and to have the mechanisms and our networks in place to be able to get that data. Our first step was to identify contaminants of concern, and that's where they brought me in as a toxicologist, and then to look at what is our health impact. So we work with our Division of Epidemiology on using the syndromic surveillance, another system that was in place that was built up over the previous 10 years with bioterrorism in mind. But we had added in some of the environmental respiratory systems into that syndromic surveillance just because we had so many other events. So again, we were more primed and I think ready to respond to some of this. We rely very heavily on partnerships with our other states because of the disasters. We have very good working relationships with the health departments in the other states, as well as with CDC, ATSDR, with NIOSH, with the FDA, EPA, and NOAA, FDA from our seafood program, but NOAA was a new agency for us. So in our public health assessment, we needed to look at the exposure and the toxicity. So crude oil is thousands of compounds. So we wanted to identify out of that what are our compounds of concern for looking at public health effects. The aliphatic hydrocarbons have a low order of toxicity, so the majority of the compounds in crude oil are not very toxic to people. When we see the issues with the birds and some of the marine life, it's not the chemical toxicity that's causing the damage, it's the coating, the physical coating of the oil. However, there are some compounds of concern in crude oil. Those are our VOCs, including benzene, and the PAHs. The polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. We looked at pathways of exposure, and in this we're looking at primarily people onshore of the general public. NIOSH and the others were looking at workers. Not that we were immune to that, but our main focus was on the general public. So we looked at inhalation of volatiles, ingestion of PAHs via seafood, dermal exposures for people came in to contact. And our at-risk populations were primarily the workers and other coastal residents. Going back here, one of the things I want to point out is that if you look on this map, if you see that red dot shows where this well was. This is a very different situation than other oil spills. That dot is 50 miles from the tip of Louisiana. So as we look, it is really far offshore. And if we look at our other Gulf states in Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, it's 100 miles or more from the site of the well. The well is also 1 mile below the surface. So as we look at that fresh oil coming out, it goes through a lot of changes before it ever gets to the coastline. From that trip from the bottom of the sea up, a lot of our volatiles and some of the other compounds are scrubbed out. You know, industrially, if you have a scrubber that's a mile long, I've never seen one that's a mile long. So that's essentially a scrubber. And once it gets on that surface, there's further weathering or degradation of that oil. And I'm going to show you that. So when people compare it to the Exxon Valdez, there's not a lot of comparison because that was a tanker spill close in, a different type of crude oil. So we have to look at these events and we have to really take into account what are the compounds there and how will those compounds get to our population. And so that's what we tried to do in our exposure assessments. So we looked at various levels of impact, individuals, families, our coastal community, and on our states itself. There's physical health impacts that we're looking at. But what we learned from Katrina, there's many more mental health impacts because there's stress, there's economic uncertainty, there's disruption of everyday life. And there, in this case, it was impact on our culture and way of life of our people who live on the coast. So there's more than just physical health involved here. This is a slide which really shows the different parts of crude oil. And the reason I have this here is that a good portion of Louisiana sweet crude oil is either gas or it's volatiles. It's estimated around 40 to 50% is going to volatilize off. What remains are the heavier aliphatic compounds, the long chain, the PAHs are in this part that remains. And it was a very heavy, thick, gooey liquid. Gooey, that scientific term gooey, is entered in. Some people define it as like pancake batter, but it has emerged as being mousse or whatever. But anyway, very thick, gooey. And then tar balls, which are almost solids. And that's the remainder in that from the petroleum that is actually that solid component. That has a very low order of toxicity, extremely low. So where we looked, where the Dr. Howard was just saying the workers offshore were those who were mainly at risk for exposure to those volatiles. As we measured the oil and the air coming inshore, the volatiles were really gone by the time they came to our general population. We are looking at the PAHs in relation to seafood. Looking at the EPA analysis, this data is all on the EPA website. Looking at the initial samples that came out from Grand Isle and Barataria Bay, we see that these lower hydrocarbons, those are our volatiles, those are totally gone. We have our next two levels of heavier hydrocarbons that are present in our mousse tar balls. PAHs, we find them in some of the weathered oil, but there's evidence that they are breaking down also. And our BTEX, which are our volatiles, that's benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene, those are gone by the time it gets to the shore. Environmental monitoring, EPA, and I'm sorry that Lisa Jackson isn't here because EPA did a monumental job in doing environmental monitoring along the coast. There's limitations to this kind of monitoring because it's screening. It's not research quality data, but it does give us an indication of what was present there on the coastline. Keeping our seafood safe. This was one of our primary focuses at the Louisiana Department of Health. Seafood is a major industry in Louisiana, and we had to make sure, first, that people were not exposed, and that as we produce seafood, it was safe for consumption. Primary goals for us. So anytime there was visible oil, it took about a month before the oil actually got onto our coastline. It was sloshing around out in the Gulf. While it was sloshing around out there, it's further weathering. You know, it had to go that 50 miles. The wind conditions were blowing it away from shore until the end of May, when the wind shifted, and that's when the Gulf impacted the area. I wonder, for people here, how many of you all heard about this oil spill on the news? Yeah, everybody, it was monumental. How many of you looked up other information beside what you got from on the news? Ah, great. So the thing about the news is that when I was very early on, I went down to Venice, and there was every news media truck in the world. I mean, Venice, Louisiana has never seen so many high-powered people. These giant trucks, satellite dishes, they all, and Venice is about 20 miles in from the mouth, but that's the end of the road. And they had their cameras there waiting to see the wave of oil coming in. And I said, what are you looking for? And they said, we want to be here and get the action photos of the oil. I said, do you know, it's not going to come here. The Mississippi River is flowing. It's spring. That oil isn't going to come up here. But they had these visions of oil coming in and of people dying, and they wanted to get those pictures. And that pervaded throughout the entire media coverage. So our national perception of what went on there is very different than when you were actually there. But when the oil came in, as soon as that oil came in, areas were closed to fishing. This was very difficult on our fishermen because this was one of our prime fishing seasons. They were getting ready to go out and start shrimping, and that was all closed down. So it's easy to close areas. It's difficult to open them. The states, Alabama, Florida, Louisiana, and Mississippi worked together to come up with a common seafood monitoring protocol for consistency. And I cannot tell you how many thousands of hours on conference calls it took to come up, but the states worked exceedingly well together. We pulled our resources, we pulled our brain power, along with EPA, CDC, ATSDR scientists, and did come up with a protocol. Now the protocol is, how do we reopen areas to show that seafood is safe? It's not a research study to say what is happening to seafood with oil. It's how do we open it when it's safe. So the first criteria is that there's not visible oil. So as opposed to some of the research studies, we're not going looking for the dirty areas because there's limited public health capacity to do these analyses. And our laboratories had to gear up both in getting new methods, in getting limits of detection that would detect these very low levels of PAHs. And so there was new equipment, there was new laboratories had to be brought online. So there wasn't excess capacity just to do research to say what are the effects. So we're looking for, if there is no visible oil, can we go in and say, is this area safe to open for fishing? A very different question. Then once there was no visible oil, there's two levels. One was sensory analysis, and the other was chemical testing. And I know whenever I say sensory analysis, people do the Snicker test, ho, ho, ho. But if you look on the web, that is a whole career line for testing seafood, because seafood smells. What did your grandmother tell you? If it smells, don't eat it. She was right. And oil is very odoriferous, so you can smell it. If you ever tasted it, it would taste nasty. So that is for really the aliphatic hydrocarbons that would be on the outside. Very effective. So the first line of screening is there visible oil? The second is, can you see or smell it on the fish? And so that filters out. Then finally, if it passes those tests, it goes on for chemical testing. And that's what people really want to know. But chemical testing is important because you're not going to do the sight or smell test for PAHs. It's only by chemical testing. But there's a very different approach. And so it's confusing. I say, people say, well, I just saw a report where the seafood has all these contaminants in it, so I'm not going to buy Louisiana seafood. I went to a restaurant for my daughter's birthday, and they said, they proudly announced, and we have salmon and all this from these different places, and we don't have any Louisiana seafood. And my question was, why? You're here in New Orleans. That's, you're not looking at the data. So there is a difference in objective. There's difference in how the samples are handled. When we're looking in research, our various groups that are looking for litigation, they're trying to find the dirtiest samples. That's the purpose of their sampling, and that's fine. The purpose of the sampling for public health departments was, can we reopen these areas? And we're not going to sample if we know it's dirty. They're going to remain clean. So the sampling is our third tier of looking. So our seafood sampling results are coming back, and we're not finding samples above the levels of concern. That's due to the screening. About 70% of the samples come back with absolutely nothing. 30% are coming back with a very low level of maybe one or two PAHs, and the two PAHs are listed below. It's not that they're coming back with 30% have a lot of PAHs. They will have an isolated PAH from one place or another. The dispersants. Dr. Howard mentioned some of the issues with dispersants. And this has carried over into our fear of seafood. There's trade-offs. But this was another thing that got caught up in the news media. And people assumed it was very toxic without ever looking at what it is. I'm convinced that the use of dispersants really saved a lot of our wetlands. It's a trade-off. More of the oil stayed offshore in the water column. It broke up. And there is evidence that it is being biodegraded at a fairly rapid rate. It kept it out of our wetlands, out of our estuaries, and more importantly, it kept us away from where people are. So in terms of protecting public health, it kept it offshore. Health surveillance in Louisiana. Our health department monitors reports from the 7 hospitals in that lower South Louisiana regions. And the Poison Control Center reports, acute health care facilities, emergency departments, and this is an ongoing program, and it was beefed up with particular care during this time to get any reports of people who came in through our medical system. There are limitations. It's self-reported. It's people who seek medical care, and it may not be totally complete reporting. We think we have a high level, but you never know. In Louisiana, we had 423 reports of complaints as of the 30th of October. The majority of these were workers. And of these, more than half were due to heat-related complaints. There were 18 hospitalizations. All those were workers. About a third of those were workers who were on a shrimp boat who were out there and had a problem with carbon monoxide. Some of the others are probably solvent-induced issues. So those were reported to us. That we by far don't have all that NIOSH does, but those were those who sought care through the Louisiana facilities. Most of the complaints dealt with odors and mild symptoms. And a lot of them, people would go in and say, I think I'm having a reaction to dispersants. The dispersants was 50 miles offshore, but hearing it over and over on television, people were convinced that the dispersants were going to rain on them. The mental health issues are unknown. One of the things our state epidemiologist did was he looked at at asthma and respiratory illnesses for the last 3 years. The black line showed the range, the high and the low for the particular week, and the red line shows this year. Clearly, we didn't have an increase in either respiratory illness or in asthma in the people who sought medical care. So that went along with some of our other environmental testing for the solvents on shore. It's more than physical health. Where we will probably see our biggest health effect is on mental health and psychosocial issues. The fear, the anxiety, and this isn't always recognized, and people do not always seek help. Communication is a major issue. How do we give out information to the public that is credible? With many of the issues, there was distrust of the government, there was mistrust of academics, there was mistrust of everyone because of the nature of this illness. I don't believe that we communicated well. We certainly didn't get enough information out clearly and quickly enough. Some of this has to do with the incident's command and their structure of communicating. So by the time any information was released, it was a couple of weeks old. So we need better thought in how do we communicate immediately with the general public and how we share what we know with them. So questions, or you want to hold questions to the end?
Yes, let's hold questions to the end. Since Dr. White is going to be here, let's hold the questions till Dr. Williamson presents. Donald Williamson is the director of the Alabama Department of Public Health. He is a physician, and he is board certified in internal medicine. He is going to speak on the public health challenges of the state of Alabama.
How do I get to the next? Well, I didn't like escape. If I go forward, didn't do anything. That wasn't a good choice.
Do you have it on the thumb drive?
I have a thumb drive.
No, I can open it. I'm just looking for it. Oops.
Thank you very much. Now, if I can figure out how to get rid of this.
Click anywhere outside of it.
Well, no, that didn't work. Thanks. This feels a little like the oil spill. I think everyone has seen the, I have no relationships other than with the Department of Health, and you've all seen those pictures. This simply shows the oil spill about a week after the rig sinks. The challenge for all of us was trying to figure out where the oil was going. These are, and one of the things that we became very, very familiar with was on a daily basis the trajectory forecast for the oil in the zones of uncertainty. And so for us, here you see some mild impact on the on some offshore islands for Louisiana as early as May the 5th. For us, this was an event that was largely an event of July. For us, during the very height of our tourist season, and in July, you see the entire coast from Louisiana to Florida is impacted with onshore oil. You all saw the brown pelican that's now world famous from Louisiana, that was coated with oil. For us, this was a hermit crab that washed ashore coated with oil. The point is, that is sort of what the oil looked like for us on our beaches. This was on the 4th of July, and there are two important points there. Number one, there's oil on the beach. Number two, there were not people on the beach. So again, the most important holiday season for our tourist economy was seriously impacted, and about 25% of the Alabama tourist dollar comes from a triangle that extends from Mobile north to a little town in Baldwin County and then down to the beach. So the impact for us was cataclysmic economically for this. Now, in looking at our responses, I think one of the challenges initially was the amount of information was extremely limited and extremely confusing. There were reports of oil washing ashore that turned out it was seaweed. We talked with our state partners, our Environmental Management Agency, our Conservation and Natural Resources Agency, our Emergency Management Agency. BP set up a command center in Mobile, and it was very quickly clear that one of the things that we had to do was coordinate this across state lines, because otherwise we would have been in that impossible situation of having states handling this different and trying to explain to our news media and the public why things were different in Mississippi and Florida than in Alabama. So one of the things we did is we set up a biweekly conference call with the state health officials. That evolved then to include our federal partners. Now, one of the things that I would say, and you've already heard this, is one of the real weaknesses that we observed was the fact that while all of us on the Gulf Coast have dealt with enough hurricanes, we understand ESF-8, we understand our role in the emergency response system. This was not that sort of response system. You had the Coast Guard and BP managing this, and they weren't, and ESF-8 and the public health response was not part of the channel that they were thinking through. They were focused on closing the well, stopping the oil intrusion. So as a result, public health was not engaged in the same way with this that we would have been with any other natural disaster. And as a result, as we look at long-term health effects, one of the challenges is going to be trying to retrospectively create what levels of actual exposure were. And that's an opportunity that we hopefully will learn from. Well, as you look at the public health response, one of the things that for Alabama that was important was, what are we going to do with beach advisors and swimming advisories? For us, we have two major areas that were impacted. One of them is largely a recreational community where renting timeshares and condos and the beach is extremely important. And on the other side of the bay, on the Mobile side of the bay, it's the fishing industry. So for us, it was swimming advisories. What are we going to do about beaches? It was seafood safety. You've already heard that. Trying to figure out what are we going to monitor and how are we going to monitor it. And for reasons that maybe are unique to Alabama, but I think not, one of the things that public health ended up with was somehow we became responsible for trying to coordinate all the testing that was going to go on and interpreting those test results. And one of the other challenges, and Dr. White mentioned it a moment ago, one of the other challenges is the lack of laboratory capacity for doing this environmental testing. And at one point there was one laboratory in Washington State that was going to do all of this testing using a protocol that apparently is too complicated for humans to actually use. And so that it forced us to develop alternative methodologies. And yet we still are struggling with having the kinds of capacities that we would ideally have. And I think all that gets to is that on a national basis, we are precariously poised with lab capacity in this country, and yet every day, going through our major cities, there are tens of thousands of gallons of potentially toxic chemicals on rail cars and tankers that should they leak, we potentially would need lab capacity. And there isn't this esoteric lab capacity just sitting out there waiting to be exploited. Our swimming advisories for us, that was a huge impact on tourism and local public health, local public concerns. Obviously, we need to do the same thing that our partners in Florida did, because the oil doesn't know whether it's an Alabama beach or a Florida beach, neither do the fish. And the questions were, where do you move from closing the beach to issuing an advisory against swimming? And how do you ever say it's safe again and reopen it? When can you tell people, don't worry, that there had been an oil exposure? Well, the other challenge here is that it really is episodic. This is a picture from September the 28th of 2010, and you can see what appears to be oil sheen on the water. This is more than a month after the well has been capped. Now, here's the challenge. That probably is oil, but it may or may not have anything to do with the oil spill that occurred in April. It could easily be from passing ships. It could be naturally occurring oil. But it's this episodic nature of the oil, and you know, we still occasionally get tar balls washing up on our shores. So that does complicate this issue. Well, we started out with a notice. It was a fairly simple notice that basically said the default position, and we issued these once we got oil intruding into the waters of Alabama. Now, we didn't do it until we had some oil wash ashore, and then that was our trigger. And we took the default position. The fact that you don't see oil does not mean that there's not oil there. Therefore, you shouldn't go into the water. And again, we thought the risk was very low, but as a matter of precaution, we maximized public health protection. As the oil dissipated, as less oil came ashore, and we got to a position where the projection showed no oil intruding on our coastline, and where we weren't getting reports of anything other than the isolated tar ball washing ashore, we took down those yellow signs and went to or red signs and went to yellow signs, which really shifted the default. They basically are an informational sign that says, be aware there was an oil spill. And there may still be oil in this water that you can't see, that we are unaware is there, and just be aware of that. But if you see oil, don't swim. Made sense. Our population didn't pay a lot of attention to that, as often happens. What about health effects? Well, again, we were trying to coordinate our messages across state. I mean, the challenge here, and this was really surprising when we started looking at the data, is there's pretty good data about the acute health effects. But there's almost no data on long-term health effects. And the one thing that as you've heard before, that's true for us, the American public, or at least our population, is almost as concerned about dispersants as they are about the oil. And there is this underlying belief that dispersants are perhaps a greater hazard. Well, if we looked at health effects surveillance, we put in place a surveillance system that looked at all of our emergency departments, that looked at community health centers in Mobile and Baldwin counties, our two impacted counties. We had 102,000 people make visits during the time period of the study. We had only 285 of those have anything that were oil related. So at no time, for example, was it more than 0.4%. So in terms of impact on capacity, it didn't have any. If you looked at the people who were most likely to report a health effect due to oil, they were largely between the ages of 25 and 49. That's probably not surprising. The one thing, again, that shouldn't have been surprising, 61% of those health effects were not due to direct exposure, but were indirect, heat exhaustion, injuring themselves during the cleanup. Again, there was very little direct health effect that we could identify. And if you looked at what they were, respiratory effects, and again, that's not asthma, that's people complaining of their throat being sore, being scratchy, some cough, some skin irritation accounted for the next most prevalent complaint. Beyond that, we did something called a CASPER survey, Community Assessment for Public Health Emergency Response, to see, A, what had we missed, and two, try to identify those things that didn't neatly fall into surveillance. And it's a study, and what you identify, in our case, 210 households in Mobile County and in Baldwin County in areas near and adjacent to the beach. We were fairly successful in getting completion. Moving on a little bit, when we started asking those households what had the impact of the oil spill been, we found that almost 60% of the households said that they were swimming less in the water. 64% were eating less seafood, and these are among people who in many cases are dependent upon seafood for their livelihood. 50% were less likely to go out boating. If we looked at the symptoms that we saw through the CASPER survey, again, nothing that surprised us. Over 50% were respiratory symptoms, cardiovascular symptoms. Some of those were chest pain related to people out working in the heat and doing cleanup. Skin irritation, eye irritation. We saw about 25% of people complaining of difficulty sleeping, and depending on the county, 12 to 22% of people who complained of being more agitated. And that is probably reflected in this data. Over a third of individuals in both of those counties reported decreased income. One of the challenges with CASPER is you don't get background data. You don't have a comparison. So the only comparison we had was using some behavioral risk factor surveillance survey data from 2009. And what we found out was that a higher percentage of them were stressed about their mortgage than the population at large in 2009, and a higher percent of them were stressed about being able to adequately feed their families than they were in 2009. In terms of oil exposure, depending on the county, again, 11 to 23% actually worked on the cleanup. Again, you see about only about a third of people had actually been exposed, and the exposure was a mix of inhalation and skin exposure. Mental health issues, which is where we think the greatest impact is going to be, a quarter of people were having trouble sleeping. 14% or so had complained of trouble concentrating, agitation again, and a diminished appetite. When we looked at senses of well-being, these were people who said that they had been ill for 14 or more days, either physically, mentally, or just had limited activity, 14 or more days out of the preceding 90 days. You saw that those were fairly high numbers, and again, they were higher than the baseline BRFSS data. Depression and anxiety, again, especially for Mobile County. Higher rates of depression than seen in the background data. There are lots of reasons for that. Mobile, in some slides that aren't in here, Mobile is a poorer county. It is more heavily dependent upon the fishing industry, and that they were probably more directly impacted in terms of economic impact than Baldwin County. The only ongoing concerns, again, it's seafood monitoring. It's not because we expect to find anything, but because of the comment that from a restaurant in New Orleans, or a comment that I had here this summer from a restaurant in Colorado. The American public still don't trust Gulf seafood, although my response would be at least ours is tested, and that's very different than much of the other seafood in the country. But in order to ensure that it is safe, I think we do have to do long-term monitoring, and it's more about marketing than it is expecting to find anything. We also found there's precious little data in terms of when can you take down those yellow signs and say you can forget worrying about oil. It turns out there's very little data about what are background levels of PAHs in Gulf waters. And so one of the things that we're working on now is a Gulf-wide sampling of water, sand, and sediment. It turns out there's absolutely no data on whether or not, for example, suntan oil expedites dermal transmission of oil compounds or hinders dermal transmission of oil compound. And if oil is buried in the sand, does it weather more or weather less? Again, it's probably not a public health problem, but it's an economic problem because city leaders on the coast really want to be able to say to the public, we've tested everything we can think of, and things are back to normal. Long-term human health effect studies, again, National Institute of Environmental Health is undertaking one of those, looking at the rostered workers. I think the challenge on that study is going to be on the exposure. We'll certainly be able to identify the outcome, but I think the challenge is, since public health was not involved early on in terms of identifying potential issues, it's going to be much harder to recreate exposure data and trying to figure out how the exposures are linked to whatever outcomes are seen. So at the end of the day, we think we were relatively fortunate in terms of acute health effects. We are pleased that our seafood areas are open. We know that there's a need for longer term monitoring there. And I think that going forward, we anticipate substantial issues with long-term mental health issues, and hopefully we'll be able to get some answers for long-term health effects. Thank you.
I want to thank both speakers for very informative presentations. And now, if you would come forward and raise any questions or express other concerns that you might have, but do speak loudly. Thank you. Thank you. Either you want to respond.
Well, I guess I have two responses. Number one, exposure doesn't directly translate into illness. Surveillance systems are never designed to capture every, or rarely designed to capture every case. They're designed in most cases to serve a simple marker for either the type of illness or to look for changes in frequency. So I guess my response is, if people are ill enough that they're seeking medical care, then that's at least giving us a snapshot of what in one end of the spectrum. I don't doubt at all that there are large numbers of people who never sought medical care, but what I don't have any reason to believe that their injury, their illness, is any different in character than that which drove people to seek medical care. Now, is the idea of doing surveillance for over-the-counter products a way to look at some burden of disease? Absolutely, we've done it. We did it during the H1N1 outbreak. And as long as one understands the very imprecise and not very specific method of looking at that, it will settle to tell you something, I think, about what may be going on in the community. It's just not very specific.
All righty. Thank you for your question and response. There was a second question.
I would like to say that it's really interesting to hear that so much was going on, because there was is with the media, and you know, what is the plan to get this information out to the affected populations? I mean, the transparency issue is huge, and I think we all learned a lot from that mining disaster in Chile, and I think that was an incredible example of what can come of transparency in communication about a very dangerous situation. And this is still ongoing, it's not over. So I just want to ask, what are we going to do to correct this major problem? I don't think it's a lesson learned.
During the time I gave over 200 media interviews, but the issue is, when you talk about public health, it's not the interesting things that the media wants to cover. Like I said, they want to see the oil flowing in. They want action. They want something that's happening. They're not the least bit interested that you're doing surveillance. And so that's not going to be what's on the media. Where I think we as public health people need to improve is how do we convey our messages better to the people who are impacted and perhaps to our other colleagues around the country. Part of the incident command is that information is very funneled, and there's not a lot of outlet for that until it's been through so many series of approvals, and by then it's a bit late. So without a doubt, communication I think is one of the major issues that, that needs to be improved, particularly for our public health activities.
Yeah, I mean, I would say we should get on the state level, public health agencies across the Gulf were putting out lots of media information. And so there wasn't a question about whether at the local level we were engaged and the public knew that. The challenge was public health was simply not something that was part of the national incident responses. And so that media coverage was all about dispersants and shutting the wells down and where the oil was washing ashore and the impact on the aquatic life. And we were telling a story that nobody wanted to cover.
Yeah, I think we cannot expect the news media to communicate for us. And I think this is something that the American Public Health Association could do in the future, is to communicate with at least the health professionals throughout the country as to what is really, really going on. The question I have for you is, and I should have asked this of John while he was here, and that is, it looks like deep water drilling is going to be pretty commonplace going forward. And I guess the things we heard from Dr. Howard were lessons learned, and it will be efforts will be initiated to make sure that the response will be different. But I'm concerned not so much about the response. I think we learned a lot about that. But what about prevention of these kind of crises in the first place?
Well, I think he brought up, he didn't go into it, but he brought up an important issue in occupational health. And that is, we look at incidents. So if we have so many lost time incidents, or we don't have those, and indeed at that well, they were getting an award because they didn't have reportable incidents. So we're looking at things one by one. What they didn't look at is the whole system, the whole culture of safety and the system. And I think that's where the emphasis has to go. And as we go forward, not just in deep water drilling, but in many industries, is that we need to think of the culture. How do we embed safety within a system? And how do we monitor the system, not just the very end of how many slips, trips, and falls that we have?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the best example is the airline industry. I mean, I assumed that planes were built never to fall out of the sky. Well, the truth is, in any human endeavor, there is the reality that something will go wrong.
Right.
And so they're built now for, I think, not to fall out of the sky more often than one out of every 1 billion flight hours. Well, the result is what you're, so we all over on that 1 billion flight hour, but what we need to do around deep water drilling and probably everything is try to engineer systems to so that we minimize the likelihood of a bad outcome. We will not eliminate it, but we have to engineer the system to minimize that bad outcome.
Yeah, if we have blowouts, we don't have to have the consequences.
Exactly.
Right, and that's what. Another question over here.
I just have a quick question for Dr. White. You mentioned that the people is fully tested, and you also mentioned people sampling. At which pH level do you consider the food safe or unsafe for consumption?
I don't know them offhand, but if you look on the FDA website, there is a whole document about how the levels were, what the levels are, how those levels were developed, and the whole risk assessment procedure behind it, and that's posted on the FDA website.
All right. Well, I thank the speakers for their patience, and you, the audience, for your attendance, and have a safe trip.